It's Thursday, April 18th. I'm Phil Picardi, and this is the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Detailed stories we'll hear on the podcast today. What will St. Cloud do without air traffic controllers? How much testing is too much testing in Minnesota schools? Up north, officials want to move a highway, and that worries towns no longer along the route. And a Red River flood update, problems on the rural Minnesota phone line, and we'll hear about refugees to Minnesota searching for health care. First, legislation to expand background checks for gun buyers has failed in the U.S. Senate. Brett Neely talked with Minnesota's senators.
Al Franken said he'd been optimistic because the bipartisan deal on background checks was co-written by Democrat Joe Manchin, who represents gun-friendly West Virginia.
I thought that would carry the day. I really did.
In the end, the amendment got 54 votes, six shy of the 60-vote threshold that Republicans insisted on for passage. Both Franken and fellow Democrat Amy Klobuchar voted to expand background checks. In a written statement, Klobuchar said she was disappointed with the outcome and plans to work with law enforcement to strengthen the background check system. As for Franken,
I thought we could get this done, but we didn't. But you know what? We'll revisit this again.
Franken plans to keep pushing for legislation to expand mental health programs in schools, something he believes still has wide bipartisan support.
Brett Neely there in D.C. More than 200 people attended a town hall meeting last night in Rochester. They discussed the Mayo Clinic's proposed expansion plan. Elizabeth Baer was there.
The hour-long forum focused on what Rochester needs to do to become a destination medical center in the next 20 years. Panelists included the bill's sponsors, DFL Representative Kim Norton and Republican Senator Dave Senjum, as well as Mayo and city officials. Olmsted County District Court Judge Kevin Lund said the Rochester community has not had enough time to assess details of the complex legislation. Lund also was concerned about how local officials will keep up with growth at the city and county level.
Are we going to be able to fund schools, police, fire, the court system, social services, mental health facilities, all of these critical component parts of the community that have not been thus far part of the discussion, nor, as far as I can tell, part of the projections.
Mayo's proposal is still making its way through the state legislature.
Liz Baer in Rochester. Back here in St. Paul, the state Senate has passed a higher education bill that both increases funding for and oversight of the University of Minnesota. Here's higher education reporter Alex Friedrich.
The bill would invest an additional $80 million into the U, but Senate Higher Education Committee Chairwoman Terry Bonoff says it must meet performance goals to get it all, and the U would have to report to the legislature how it spends money on administration.
We have several places within our overall omnibus bill pointed to our commitment that the University of Minnesota respond to the public's perception that the administrative costs are exceeding what we consider to be an acceptable standard.
The bill would also prohibit the use of state money to fund administrative bonuses. In December, a Wall Street Journal article suggested the U had one of the largest percentages of administrators among U.S. universities.
Alex Friedrich there, now Annie Baxter. She says a new survey shows the cost of health care is one of the top concerns of the state's manufacturing executives.
Since 2008, the trade group Enterprise Minnesota has conducted a yearly survey of 400 manufacturers about their confidence in the future. The percentage of respondents citing health care as their top concern peaked in 2011, the year after Congress passed the federal health care overhaul. However, health care costs continue to be a major worry. Rob Autry conducts the poll. He says nearly 70% of manufacturers surveyed expect health care costs to rise in the next 2 to 3 years.
You mix that with, I think, uncertainty about what's going on in Washington, and I think there's enough to give them pause.
However, 82% of survey respondents still expressed confidence about the future of their own company this year, unchanged from 2012.
That's Annie Baxter on business. Speaking of business and health care, Minnetonka-based United Health Group says its first quarter net income dropped 14%. The health insurer says medical costs climbed, and it booked a smaller gain due to leftover insurance claims. In the 3 months that ended March 31st, United Health says it earned $1.19 billion. That's down from $1.39 billion a year ago. The Federal Aviation Administration says it will close 149 air traffic control towers across the nation because of federal budget cuts known as sequestration. One of the towers is at the Anoka County Blaine Airport. The other is at the St. Cloud Regional Airport, where Conrad Wilson reports officials say the closure will hinder efforts to expand air service.
It's a windy day at the St. Cloud Regional Airport as a single-engine prop plane comes in for landing.
CAP 2147, runway 5, clear to land, wind 06015.
Clear to land, runway 5, CAP 2147.
Brian Dickinson is one of the air traffic controllers. From his perch in the air traffic control tower, 80 feet above the runway, he's responsible for aircraft coming and going around the airport.
For the most part, we're pretty slow, but we do have busier moments.
If all goes according to plan, Dickinson and the rest of the air traffic controllers in St. Cloud will be out of work when the Federal Aviation Administration shutters the tower in mid-June. The closure comes as the airport is actively working to expand air service with daily nonstop flights to Chicago. St. Cloud Mayor Dave Kleiss is part of the citywide effort to bring more commercial air service to the region.
It's not preventing those things from happening, but it's not helpful. I mean, it's not something that, we lead with, the fact that the tower is closed.
Airport Director Bill Towle says the closure makes St. Cloud a harder sell to airlines.
If there are some things that are kind of going against St. Cloud, and then they also see that we don't have an air traffic control tower, they might say, boy, that kind of pushes us over the edge to not receive service.
Whether or not the tower closure affects St. Cloud's air service ambitions, it will have an impact on the airport's existing operations. The same goes for 148 other airports around the country where towers could go dark at the beginning of the summer. Federal budget cuts, known as the sequester, are forcing the FAA to reduce its budget by $637 million. The St. Cloud Airport is used by military helicopters, private and commercial jets, as well as students learning to fly. Dickinson, the air traffic controller, says without the tower, takeoffs and landings will be more difficult.
The pilots will have to call up and then kind of talk to each other when they enter the airspace and find out where each other are and come up with a plan themselves to figure out how to get to the runway.
In March, the FAA first announced its plans to close the towers and provided the guidelines it was using to make those decisions. Part of the criteria the agency used was the number of airport operations, which is simply a takeoff or a landing. Airport Director Towle says his airport has roughly 40,000 operations per year.
They pulled this number out of a hat, 150,000 operations or less. That means your tower was at risk, and or it was 10,000 commercial operations, and then your tower would be on the chopping block.
Across the country, the pending closures have raised questions about safety. Tal says pilots are trained to fly and frequently do out of uncontrolled airspace.
Obviously, we will be less safe without the tower. We're not going to be unsafe, but we're going to be less safe. And again, it's that extra set of eyes and ears that that we like to have up there.
Twice per week, Allegiant Air provides commercial service between St. Cloud and Mesa, Arizona. The airline started flying in December, bringing commercial service back to the region for the first time since Delta pulled out in late 2009. Right now, Allegiant only flies into one market where the airspace is not controlled. Unless Congress reaches a budget deal, that number will grow to 11. Jessica Wheeler is a spokesperson for Allegiant. She says the airline's preference is to have an air traffic control tower, but doesn't plan to pull out of St. Cloud.
We have every intention of continuing service as usual. Our pilots are more than trained so that there's no, like I said, no sacrifice in safety without it.
St. Cloud officials say they're lobbying Minnesota's congressional delegation with the hope lawmakers might be able to come up with a solution that would keep the tower open.
Conrad Wilson there in St. Cloud. For students and teachers in Minnesota, this time of year is all about testing. From March until early May, students take the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment Tests, or the MCAs. And MCAs come after any number of tests, from daily exams to international assessments. And some educators say it's time to reevaluate. Here's Tim Post.
It's easy to see how students and parents might get lost in the alphabet soup that is testing in Minnesota. There's the MCA, the MAP test, the GRAD test, the ACT, and occasionally the TIMSS test, the PISA test, and the NAEP test. The result of all that testing, according to Eric Sievertson, a physics teacher in Malacca, is that students aren't quite sure which tests are the most important.
I think that all gets lost, and, you know, the students, well, this test counts, this one doesn't. This one affects the school district, this one doesn't.
The Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments, or MCAs, could be considered the state's most important test. It's high stakes all around. The test tracks how students are doing, and therefore how schools and teachers are performing as well. Older students need to pass the reading and writing portion of the test to get a diploma. They don't have to pass the math portion, but if they fail it three times, they need to show they're proficient by doing extra work or other projects. Tom Dewar, the president of the Teachers Union Education Minnesota, thinks the state is obsessed with high-stakes testing. Dewar says teachers spend too much time preparing students for their MCAs.
Teach kids testing strategies. Teach them about what are some ways to, you know, dissect a question. Taking practice tests, then taking time to do the tests, and then retest for those that didn't do well.
Dewar says the MCAs aren't a useful tool for teachers, because most of the results take months to roll in.
They come back the next school year, so those students that you had in fourth grade, you're getting the results when they're in fifth grade, so it really doesn't make any sense.
This is the third year the Minnesota Department of Education has allowed schools to give students an online version of the MCA math test, partly in an effort to give teachers speedier data. Earlier this week, a server glitch prevented some students from completing their tests. No problems were reported when students started their testing again on Wednesday. But it's another example of what teachers see as the hassle of testing. Glitches can throw students off and hurt their test scores. Adding to the overall load of testing, about half of Minnesota's 471 school districts do something called MAP testing to measure students' academic progress in a way they say the MCAs fall short. Minnesota Education Commissioner Brenda Caselius says the state's goal is to improve the MCAs, make them less intrusive and something teachers can use throughout the year, like MAP tests. She wants the MCAs to be the test districts rely on.
It could mean less testing if districts choose to eliminate all other testing and just use the state tests.
State lawmakers are considering a bill this session that would tweak assessment testing in Minnesota. The measure would allow the Department of Education to put more MCA tests online and make them more robust. It would also align high school assessments with the tests students take to get into college, like the ACT. And it would get rid of the grad exams students need to pass to get a diploma. But it wouldn't necessarily reduce the amount of testing students face. Michael Rodriguez, an associate professor in the University of Minnesota's College of Education, says that's okay.
If we found very effective ways of using all of that testing information to inform teaching and learning, to improve teaching and learning, then the volume of testing wouldn't be such an issue.
Rodriguez says testing in schools has yet to strike the perfect balance between providing teachers with the data they need to help students while not taking too much time away from learning.
Tim Post on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Officials on the Iron Range are meeting with MnDOT today to discuss how to relocate a major highway. The state has to move Highway 53 between Eveleth and Virginia to make way for an open-pit taconite mine expansion. But a proposed option would bypass both towns. And Dan Crocker says that's raised the ire of many local business owners.
More than 10,000 vehicles travel on Highway 53 through Eveleth every day, right past E.J. Dawson's Five Seasons Sports.
And everyone that seems to go by looks over here to see what we have. This highway out here has been an asset for me.
Dawson has sold snowmobiles, ATVs, and other motorized recreational equipment here for four decades. Now he's wrapping up a $1.5 million expansion and remodel. Dawson says he only undertook the project after MnDOT assured him the highway would remain in front of his dealership.
They better darn follow their word. Now, whether it's more costly, that's the way it is. They spend millions and millions in the Twin Cities, and nothing is ever thought about it. Up here, because we have one project that's going to be expensive, all of a sudden, it's way too expensive for MnDOT.
About a half mile north of Dawson's dealership, Highway 53 runs past the United Taconite plant belonging to Cliffs Natural Resources. Cliffs now wants to mine the land under 53, and it has the legal right to do so. Under a 1960 agreement, the state made a commitment to move the highway when the company was ready to mine under it. The difficulty for MnDOT is there just aren't many viable places to put the road in a region that's pockmarked by operating mines and abandoned pits. Roberta Dwyer is overseeing the relocation project for MnDOT.
You have United Taconite, you have the ArcelorMittal mine to the north, and then you have U.S. Steel
Minntac plant, which is undergoing a major expansion right now. If there's a great solution, we would like to know that because we haven't been able to find it.
MnDOT had narrowed down the reroute to two options. The most direct would have spanned the current United Taconite mine pit. But Cliffs recently said that option wasn't feasible because of safety, environmental, and other issues. So MnDOT is now weighing another option that would turn a straight shot 3-mile trip north from Eveleth to Virginia into a 15-mile journey to the south, west, and then back north. Traffic headed north would bypass Eveleth entirely, but not Virginia. Still, Virginia City Council member Don Cipolla says what's referred to as the westerly option raises serious public safety concerns, especially for a 300-home neighborhood called Midway. The subdivision lies between the two towns. The proposed 53 reroute would make Midway effectively 20 miles from the area hospital in Virginia.
A cardiac arrest in Midway might not get ambulance care for 20 minutes or longer by taking the westerly route and having to cross a number of railroad tracks where long mine trains often cross.
The city of Virginia instead prefers to route the highway over the abandoned Richelieu pit. That's several hundred feet deep and partially filled with water. MnDOT's Roberta Dwyer says that option would require a bridge with piers over 200 feet tall.
This would be unique to Minnesota, not unique in the world. We're really looking at a Hoover Dam type of bridge structure here.
Which some people would probably say, that's pretty cool, bring it on.
A lot of people have said that, and one of the advantages that people have seen is that this would be a grand gateway into the city of Virginia.
But an expensive gateway. MnDOT says that route could cost as much as $160 million. MnDOT's Dwyer says so far the state has set aside only $60 million in bonding funds for the project. Back in Eveleth, Bill Aho's Super 8 Motel sits right next to Highway 53. Aho says that rerouting the highway away from his property would devastate his business.
It would probably ruin me. I'll be very, very frank with you. That highway is very, very precious.
Aho says every summer his parking lot fills with license plates from Arkansas to Iowa, tourists en route to the Boundary Waters or Canadian fishing trips. This highway is critical, he says, not only to his business, but the entire region. MnDOT's goal is to have the new highway in place, wherever it is, by 2017.
Dan Crocker in Duluth. Some rural phone customers have trouble receiving long-distance calls. Folks say some incoming long-distance calls are either dropped or not completed at all. The FCC says it appears the problem stems from third-party long-distance carriers trying to save money. Here's Tom Robertson.
Steve Fogelson co-owns a sporting goods store in Bemidji. About 20% of the business at Up North Sports comes over the phone from customers all over the country. But Fogelson says for the past few years, long-distance calls coming into the store have been unreliable.
We'll be talking to people and the call will just drop. Or people will try to call us and they can't get through. And we get phone calls from hopefully most of them, but we don't know how many people just kind of give up and don't call us back.
Customers complain they can hear the ringing on their end, but the phone doesn't actually ring in the store. Fogelson estimates there's trouble with more than a third of the long-distance calls coming in.
It gets real frustrating for us because being in small business, you know, every sale that you miss hurts the bottom line.
Fogelson reported the problems to his local phone provider, Paul Bunyan Communications in Bemidji. Company spokesman Brian Bissonette says Paul Bunyan fielded more than 400 similar complaints last year, and they continue to get dozens more each month. Paul Bunyan technicians determined the trouble wasn't a local problem. They learned it was happening to rural customers across the country.
As you can imagine, they're frustrated with not being able to receive calls. The caller who's trying to reach them is frustrated because they can't reach them. And we're stuck in the middle trying to get the thing resolved.
Suppose you're trying to call Steve Fogelson at Up North Sports in Bemidji. That call might originate from a network belonging to a big long-distance company like AT&T, Sprint, or Verizon. But the call might also be routed through half a dozen third-party service providers. Those companies promise to route the call to its destination at the lowest possible cost. The trouble is, mid-level carriers have to pay more when the call ends up in a rural area like Bemidji. That's because there are fewer customers to support the phone network, so routing access charges are typically higher. Telecommunications experts suspect those mid-level routing companies may be dropping calls intentionally to avoid the higher access charges in rural areas. Bissonnett says rural telephone associations and members of Congress have put pressure on the FCC to fix the problem.
People have an expectation, consumers, and rightfully so, when you pick up the phone to dial it, the call's going to be completed. And if it isn't, it's for a technical reason that can be fixed, and not because of a decision by a company because they want to try to cut costs.
In 2011, the FCC put out rule clarifications to make sure long-distance companies understood that it's illegal to block calls to rural areas. Earlier this year, the agency proposed new rules that would require companies to report call completion data. Last month, the FCC took its first enforcement action against a long-distance company called Level 3 that's suspected of blocking calls. In a settlement with the FCC, Level 3 agreed to hand over data about the actions of its affiliated companies. It will also pay a $1 million penalty. Michael Steffen is a legal advisor with the FCC. Steffen says the data from Level 3 will help identify other companies that are not following the rules.
We didn't expect any single settlement or enforcement action to be a silver bullet. This is a complicated problem. We have a multi-pronged effort ongoing. But we have made clear that we take this extremely seriously.
Some telecom companies report that call completion problems have gotten worse in recent months. The FCC's proposed rule changes designed to fix that will likely be approved later this year.
Tom Robertson there in Bemidji. We close out the podcast with two stories about the lovely weather and a story about a debut at the Twin Cities Film Festival. First, the National Weather Service is increasing the flood risk along the Red River because of the delayed spring melt and recent snowfall. Dan Gunderson has a look at the new numbers.
The Weather Service now says there's a 50% chance the Red River will reach 40.3 feet in Fargo-Moorhead. That's 2 feet higher than the most recent flood outlook, and just below the record flood of 40.8 feet in 2009. National Weather Service forecaster Greg Gust says Fargo-Moorhead should prepare for a flood of record.
Minimum we can get there now, and 42 is the probable maximum, and that's taking into account that there could be at least one more heavy precipitation event coming up here.
Fargo officials say they will build sandbag dikes to 44 feet to protect against a 42-foot flood. Sandbag filling operations will resume Thursday in Fargo to prepare an additional 500,000 sandbags. Most permanent levees built in Fargo and Moorhead since 2009 are constructed to an elevation of 44 feet. Forecaster Greg Gust says because the spring melt is so late this year, there's no longer any historical flood data for comparison. The latest crest from spring flooding in Fargo-Moorhead is April 19th. Gust says this year's flood crest will likely be 2 weeks past that date.
This is uncharted territory. Heavy precipitation has occurred and is expected to occur. Snow water that is out there right now is sufficient for a big flood.
Gust says the late spring creates two big unknown factors. Temperatures could warm rapidly into the 60s, and late April and early May often bring heavy rain.
Thursday, we're expecting a fairly significant band of snow. We are expecting upwards of a half an inch or more of moisture back into the southernmost part of this basin. That is figured into this calculation. What isn't figured out is how dramatic and how much additional precipitation really could occur out there.
Gust says rivers should start flowing late this week or early next. When those rivers crest and how high they get will depend on weather conditions over the next 2 weeks.
Dan Gunderson in Moorhead, now Mark Stile in Worthington. He says state officials have asked FEMA to assess ice storm damage in southwestern Minnesota.
Last week's storm damaged thousands of power poles, causing widespread electricity outages. The inch-thick ice also snapped so many tree limbs, one official said it was raining branches. Doug Neville with the State Department of Public Safety said the FEMA personnel will meet with local officials to tote up the damage bill.
We've requested the preliminary damage assessments for five counties. It's Cottonwood, Jackson, Murray, Nobles, and Rock counties.
He says the assessment will go to Governor Dayton, who will decide whether to ask for a presidential disaster declaration. If the area gets that declaration, state agencies will work with FEMA to help storm victims apply for aid.
That's our reporter, Mark Stile. Now, for the past 7 years, Twin Cities filmmaker Chris Newberry has been documenting the lives of refugees as they try to navigate the healthcare system in Minnesota. As Nikki Tundell reports, their stories will hit the big screen tonight as part of the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival.
Filmmaker Chris Newberry started out as a screenwriter, a purveyor of fictional tales. But some stories, he says, just call for the reality of a documentary.
You're not writing a script about Abraham Lincoln and then dressing someone up like Abraham Lincoln and filming that. I mean, that is really cool, but to actually be witnessing the story as it plays out, it just kind of scratches that itch for me to find out more about the world around me.
And that was the case with Newberry's latest project. His documentary, American Heart, follows the lives of three refugees as they seek health care in Minnesota. Patrick is a refugee from Burma who loves writing songs and sleeps with his guitar. He seems to always be smiling, even when hooked up to rows of machines monitoring his heart condition. Tor survived Cambodia's killing fields, but is now dying from liver cancer. Then there's Alex, who in the early 1980s fled the violence of his Ethiopian homeland. He walked for 2 years straight, avoiding flying bullets and packs of hungry hyenas to reach safety in Sudan.
In all these years, I am still having bad dreams about the past.
Alex is now an American citizen. He no longer fears being assassinated by Ethiopian troops in the night. But, says filmmaker Chris Newberry, there are now other threats to Alex's life.
His health has been deteriorating. He's got diabetes. He is a recovered alcoholic. He is a smoker, has heart disease. Then he's got all his mental health challenges.
Like depression and PTSD. A doctor in the film explains the complex interplay between past trauma and current well-being.
They bring many things with them from the experience of being a refugee. Memories of a war, or rape, or torture, or the loss of 20 or 30 members of their family. And that tremendously impacts their health. The two are inextricably connected, the issues of depression and physical health. And the consequences of PTSD, for many people, never go away. They stay with you your entire life.
Luckily, says Chris Newberry, there are places like Health Partners Center for International Health, which caters specifically to immigrants and refugees. It's here that much of the film takes place.
Whenever you know that you need to get medical attention right away, you call 911, okay?
911.
The St. Paul Clinic provides both physical and mental health care. It employs countless translators. And, says Newberry, it tries to respect the cultural practices of the patient's home countries, even when they differ from American norms.
In a lot of cultures, there's an expectation that a doctor giving a dire diagnosis, perhaps the doctor will give the news to one of the adult children of the patient. Then the family will decide whether or not the patient even gets to know that they have cancer. And that's out of respect for the patient. The family has decided that that patient doesn't want to know that they have 6 months to live.
The documentary American Heart isn't an examination of the country's medical system, and it's not a statement on who should or shouldn't receive health care. The film's goal, says Newberry, is a simple one, to offer a look into the real lives of real people as they face all too real health challenges.
This is kind of a brief window into what the refugee experience is like for some people. Hopefully from that, people might be a little bit more curious. They might have a little bit more respect for refugees and what they've been through and what they go through once they're resettled.
Chris Newberry's American Heart premieres at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival on Thursday night at 6:30. Nikki Tundell, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
And that's it for this Thursday NPR News Update. Friday's news on your schedule, right here again tomorrow. I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for joining me.